Muller House Meeting, Monday afternoon, 7th April 1975. This morning we tried to see how it was that in ancient India the Holy Ones arrived at the statement of the identity of Brahman and Atma. Each of those words equally stands for realized transcendence. The Upanishadic teachings unequivocally affirm that Brahman is the totality. They equally unequivocally affirm that Atma is the totality. And then they affirmed that Brahman is identical with Atma without presenting any logical case to show why they considered that the two were identical. We have tried to see how it is that that statement could have come about. Now, this statement is the very heart of the whole of the Upanishadic teaching. It has had such immense vitality that it has influenced the whole of religious thinking and philosophy, as well as philosophy in its more restricted sense, for at least 30 centuries or more. And in our own day and age, this statement always lies as the ultimate root of all that emerges in terms of religious teaching and philosophy. We can see the importance of this, therefore. If we look at this statement very carefully, we will see that one of its outstanding significances is that man and God are intimately related. The theistic theologies of the world have also emphasized the intimate relationship between man and God. But they have always preserved a distinction between man, the creature, the created, the limited and the finite, and God, the infinite, the mysterious unknown, the absolute, the transcendent, the altogether transcendent. Now, the significance of the Upanishadic teaching, as it stands, pushes aside that distinction. It is equivalent to saying, if Brahman is identical with Atma, that Brahman is man and man is Brahman. Man is the ultimate reality veiled. not fully manifesting Brahman. Through man, Brahman comes to self-realization in terms of the human manifested form. If you study the Bhagavad Gita very carefully, you will find that this is fully borne out in the teachings ascribed to Sri Krishna. Now, it is very interesting to note that Eckhart said in so many words, "Man verily is God, and God verily is man." Now, this is a tremendous statement to make, and it comes from one of the supreme mystic philosophers and intellectual geniuses that the Christian world produced. Remember, he lived in a wonderful age in European history, as far as this aspect of our life, that is, mysticism and religion, are concerned. He and Tauler, Dante, Albertus Magnus, St. Thomas Aquinas, and so many others, and on the Jewish side, people like Moses de Leon and Abraham Abu Lafia flourished in that period. And it was a period when it was dangerous to make any such statement, because the church had laid down that God is the wholly other than man. No man could presume to express identity between God and man. And yet Eckhart made this statement unequivocally in so many words. You find this idea in a veiled form, perhaps, in a less emphatic form, in the Old Testament too, when in the very first chapter of Genesis, the Elohim says, "Let us make man in our own image." Now it must be remembered that this image is a living image, because man is a living creature. So man was made in the image of Elohim, in the image of God, as we ordinarily say. Now if man was made in the image of God, then man verily is God. And God verily is man. You find this also reflected in the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest, Hermes the thrice greatest. His teachings are, of course, derived from the teachings of the Egyptian mystics and initiates, the really great initiates, where it is stated that God, all Father mind, this is the fascinating part, God, all Father mind, then created man in his own image, with whom he fell in love because he was so like his father, God the Creator. so beautiful. It's a wonderful thing. And it's interesting, of course, that this is presented in the Hellenistic form of Egyptian teaching, of ancient Egyptian teaching. And the Hellenes, the Greeks, were the great exponents of the principle of beauty. Plato, as you know, included beauty in one of the three ultimate archetypal ideas upon which the universe rests. Idea meaning not so much as in our sense a thought or a concept, but as a great archetypal force, a power, a transcendent power operating throughout the universe. That is what Plato means by the ideas, the idea. So we find this teaching in some form or other. Sometimes a little bit softened down, because most people cannot take the idea, cannot take the responsibility involved in the acceptance of such a teaching, that man verily is God, and God verily is man. Now, we must also remember that Eckhart, who used those words, in his teaching did make the distinction between Gottheit, the Godhead, and God. He made the distinction. And the distinction is of this nature, that when we use the word God, it represents our human ultimate conception of the inconceivable, unimaginable Godhead. You see, the same occurs in the presentation of philosophers in India like Sri Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya, who is regarded as one of the greatest of the Vedantic teachers, he too distinguishes clearly between Brahman, which is the real equivalent of Eckhart's Godhead. He makes a distinction between Brahman and Ishvara, between Brahman and Narayana, another name for God. Of course, there are several such names, and each has its distinctive connotation. Narayana probably is the nearest Indian term to the Christian term God, the personal being who is the supreme being, creator, lord, and master of the universe, and of course of man. But now, the time has come, perhaps the new age, which already has dawned, when this shrinking from the responsibility of accepting the ultimate fact of our own nature will dissolve. We shall be free of that fear of recognizing that man is God, God is man. Just as in the human kingdom alone, there are men of excellence, of perfection, or comparatively of perfection, And there are men who are, as we call them, ordinary men, and there are men who are bad men. If we bear that in mind, then we shall realize that those of us who are ready and have this passion, this care for the transcendent reality, will be willing to cast aside this fear. And if there is the true love of transcendence, a love which cannot be defined in human terms, ordinary human terms, if that love is there, then it will cast out fear. There'll be no fear. And something else. It will also cast out conceit, arrogance, pride, ambition. You remember Shakespeare's words, "Cromwell, I charge thee, fling away ambition. By that sin fell the angels." The great story of Lucifer, the brightest of the angels, falling into hell because he aspired to equality with God, is very significant. All these stories tell us the truth about ourselves. There was no such person called Lucifer up beyond the clouds, beyond the sky. And there is no person sitting up there called God with whom he had a quarrel. These are ways of talking, symbolical ways of talking about you, about me, about all human beings. These are the things which happen within the ambit of our own consciousness, our own psyche and body, our own living experience. And through the ages, whenever that experience quite transcended the ordinary limits of our human frailty and incapacity, then those sages very naturally put all these inward realizations in terms of such myths. These are myths. But the myth is the soul of the fact. It is the inner soul of the actual fact. And that is why, if we purify our minds and hearts, then with the mind quiet, intelligence awakes, functions, and sees the truth of our own being. It sees the truth of ourselves with our failings. It also sees the truth about ourselves in relation to the supreme possibility that lies within man, the living being. Because remember, after all the scriptures of the world were written or were taught by you and I, by human beings like you and I. There are those who say, oh no, the word of God was given by revelation to his chosen one. That is a way of talking about what actually happens. When you yourself, utterly pure, still and silent, are open to transcendence, you, the living being, are the condition of, are in the condition of revelation. The revelation is your being, actually. And then, thought and speech gives a form to this actual living fact which was present. That is revelation. Not communicating a set of ideas or words to another person. It is you, the living being. We think we know the meaning of life. We don't. We are so blind, we are so ignorant. We know nothing of the marvel and mystery and wonder of the universe, of ourselves. So now, this distinction between Godhead and God is a very instructive distinction, and I bring it to your attention because Eckhart is one of the supreme shining lights of the Christian world. Now, we have been considering the religious life as a life in which there is the purification of the mind and the heart effected. And as I said this morning, if that purification is there, if there is inward poise, and when there is freedom from isolative self-consciousness, that is, when we are free of the consciousness of ourself as the observing or experiencing subject, separate from that which we observe or experience, when those three conditions are there, then the senses are the cords of communion. Now, this is extremely important. Bear in mind that this tremendous Upanishadic realization of the identity of Brahman and Atma, the identity of God and man, was realized in specific states of meditation in the first instance, in the state of profoundest contemplation, dhyana, which had reached its peak point, which is samadhi. Samadhi is the peak point of dhyana. Now do realize that the common conception that samadhi is attained is a mistake. You can't attain the infinite. You can't attain that which is beyond all thought, beyond all limitation, beyond all measurement. Attainment is possible only where you can measure. And that which is measurable is finite. It belongs to the realm of mortality, not of the immortal. So now, samadhi is never attained. Samadhi comes into being when this attentiveness glows with such white-hot intensity that the separation in consciousness between self and not-self has completely vanished. Then the state of samadhi is there. This is a very, very important point to bear in mind. And I'm afraid even the Indian scriptures and writings have not put this clearly. They have given the impression through the centuries that you strive to attain and finally you attain. This is not the case. There is no striving. There is only the release of the transcendent reality, the transcendent fact, because I have ceased to obstruct that reality, to obstruct that fact. When I, this self, this separative self-consciousness is out, the Lord is present, the totality is present. When the death consciousness is out, the eternal life consciousness is present. Death consciousness is a special thing because it is the finite object, which the finite person who can die. The infinite cannot die. It cannot be born. It is the infinite. So, when I remove this dirt, the death consciousness, the separate person consciousness. It is the consciousness of eternal God which is then functioning. And samadhi has this meaning too. Adi means the topmost, the supreme, the intensest, the completest, the without limitation, adi, you see, and sung together. It is the supreme togetherness. You see how beautiful it becomes, how obviously true it becomes when you see this. That when all separative self-consciousness is out and the psychophysical organism is utterly pure, then there is this perfect togetherness between you, the living being, and the totality, the one total reality, which is Godhead, Godhead itself. There is no separation there. It's a wondrous thing. And this is the supreme state of communion, the ultimate realization. Now, if one sees this and if one is in that condition, that is revelation. And you will see, obviously, that there is no room for conceit, because I have done nothing. The reality is just manifesting itself freely now. That is all. And it is the absolute all. Now, so this identity of Brahman and Atma was realized in this state of samadhi. And it is expressed in thought and word after coming back from this total and transcendent awareness to the ordinary limited consciousness of everyday life, where the senses and the discursive mind, the thought process, the speech process function again. Then that somehow tries to give a formulation to it. You may ask that if in that transcendent condition the awareness totally defeats all formulation and description, how can you possibly formulate it and describe it afterwards? This too is not sufficiently explained in the Upanishads. But it seems that what happens is this. Whenever you are in any of those transcendent conditions, it leaves an indelible impress, an impress upon the whole psychophysical organism. That impression never goes away. It is there. If here in our ordinary everyday consciousness, you the person have the gift for letting some extraordinarily illuminating conception, thought to arise, and if you can put the best possible words to it, then you can talk about it and communicate something to another person. All the scriptures are the word of God in that sense, inspired words. And not only are they inspired words, but even more, they are inspiring words for him who is open and sensitive. And he has to have sufficient purity inside himself, mental and moral. And then scripture comes to life. It is pure light. Now let us pass on to the next step, which is of such very great importance. You remember we ended up with this statement this morning, that the senses are the cords of communion, and then you realize happiness in its most concrete form here and now. The Holy One, who is sort of, so to say, permeated by the light of transcendence, the energy, the perfection, the purity of transcendence, when he functions in ordinarily in everyday life, using his eyes, his ears, his sense of touch, and so on, uses them as an instrument, as a living vehicle of transcendence. Consider this carefully. If I, as the separate individual, and am empty, that is to say, all that obstructs reality and truth is removed, then, as my sense of sight or sense of hearing functions, there is no interpretation of what I see or hear which is spoilt by my own limitation or conditioning. I no longer interpret the experience of seeing in the limited way in which we all interpret. Let us take a concrete example. We all see that object and say, that is a chair. And when we say that is a chair, we have the picture in our minds of a physical object which serves the purpose for people to sit upon. That is essentially a chair as such. We look at the chair and say that it is made of wood and whatever else it is made of, and our whole conception involved with the word chair is this conditioned conception. Of course it is true. That particular conception is true. But it is true within the limited context of our experience of sitting down, of making it, of using certain materials to make it, of polishing it, and so forth and so forth. All that is involved in the word chair. But supposing I have been so impressed, my mind has been so impressed by the knowledge which modern science gives us, that that object which I call a chair is actually composed of countless millions of atoms. None of these atoms are solid like that chair. You try to sit upon an atom and see what happens. And the concept and the knowledge of atoms tells us that an atom means nothing which is a particle. In our sense of the word particle, something hard, something which you can pick up, something which has a specific size, and something which will stay on the floor or the table if you put it there. It's something utterly different. It's just energy, pure energy, mainly, as we say, electrical energy. An atom is a congeries, a collection of energies at play. When the man of the world reads what the scientist has produced, he forms pictures in his mind which are very conditioned pictures. That is why you can always make out whether the man who starts talking very learnedly about atoms and electrons and mesons and all the rest of it really knows what he's talking about, or whether he's merely repeating words which he has read in a book written by a scientist. You see, what is in the mind of the ordinary man regarding atoms and energy and so on is quite different from what is in the mind of the scientist. The scientist who knows is one in whose mind there is freedom from all the conditioned pictures which obstruct the ordinary man. You see? Now, I as an ordinary man, looking at that, say, yes, that's a chair. I look out of the window and say, there is a mountain, there is the sky and the light and so forth. But I'm interpreting all that according to my conditioning, according to the limitations in my own being which I impose upon and restrict what my sense of sight conveys to me. Now, feel this out very sensitively. If all that conditioning is out, if the mind is completely empty of all obstruction, pure, a new state of awareness comes into being. A transcendent state of awareness comes into being as I look at you or look at the carpet or look at those books and so on. I see you, the carpet, those books, as finite objects, a carpet, or you, the particular person, or the particular book. But at the same time, there is infinity embodied in every finite object or person. In other words, through my eyes, the eyes of this living person here, transcendence itself is looking. And it sees infinity and eternity embodied in each and every single object and person. You have to meditate in deep silence, in quietude, by yourselves, to begin to get the thrill of this, to experience it. And you will find extraordinary things happening. One of the things is this. You will find that obviously there is no room whatsoever for any of the evil things, greed, hate, delusion, fear, ambition, all these things are out. Instead, there is an infinite power of compassion. A wellspring of compassion comes out of you all the time, which has not any emotional expression. It has a transcendent expression. And that transcendent expression has the power to heal whatsoever it flows into, and to transmute, actually to transmute that which it touches. There is no real room for our limited petty emotions in this, or our particular limited thought in it. A new dimension of being and consciousness is operating when you yourself are looking. transcendence is looking through your eyes and all this is happening. You see, the sleepless, immortal eyes of eternal God send their light, their love, their healing through your eyes when you are the perfected Holy One. You see our responsibility? The Holy Ones of the type of Eckhart, of Shankara. And I could give you 100 names throughout the Upanishads. The writers of the great hymns of the Rig Veda. The man who wrote the Bhagavad Gita. And so on and so on. There are numberless such names. The Buddha, for instance, in one of his discourses, gives the 104 names of perfected Holy Ones. 104 names he mentions. So, when I see, when I hear, when I touch, there is no distorting of that which is seen or heard or touched by my defects or conditioning. In fact, this living person has become free of defects and conditioning. That is the point. Therefore, this sort of thing takes place. This is the meaning of the statement made by the great devotees and seers through the ages, that the Lord and Master, when he was living on earth amongst men, was God incarnate. This is the meaning of that statement. You yourself become the Holy Grail. I mentioned this the other day. The Grail of transcendence. You are the cup, the chalice, the cup which has no bottom, no sides. Your living being is the cup, the holy cup. This sort of idea has been beautifully expressed also in the teachings of the great Greeks. Orpheus and Pythagoras and Plato. Plato puts it in beautiful forms. You see, about the soul which comes through the starry solitudes and passes the closed ring of the zodiac, and it enters through the constellation of Krater, the cup. This is a symbolical way of talking of what happens to you. Now you see, you and I were created like that, man. Man in the image of God. Now can you understand the statement, for God so loved the world. And our whole task is to be free from worldliness. When we are really free from worldliness, then we cease to grasp the world, we cease to afflict it. And to afflict ourselves. Now, transcendence sees and hears what? The object in its finitude embodying infinity. In other words, transcendence sees and hears and touches its own eternal being through the mortal, the finite person. What a mystery, what a marvel. You remember St. Paul's words in the Epistle to the Corinthians, that he was taken up into the third heaven. And the same sort of teaching comes in the Rig Veda with respect to Yama, who becomes the Lord of Death. the master of death, who has transcended death. He was taken up into the third heaven, and he heard things not lawful for man to speak about. In those days they kept such things esoteric, secret, because they would be misused. So transcendence sees itself. What a wonderful destiny is yours, men and women in the world, that through your eyes and ears and your brain, transcendence can see its own wonder and beauty, hear it, know itself. What can my brain ordinarily know? All the petty little things which belong to the sphere of mortality. But in the holy state, it is this very brain, this little thing, through which eternal God sees eternal God. You see, one can be carried away by words, by thoughts, and say, oh, how beautifully expressed, poetically expressed. But never mind all that. What matters is that we should be so sensitive to this, feel it so intensely, free of the particular shape in which it is presented to you, you see, that extraordinary transformation takes place inside. You see what it means to raise someone from the dead? The miracle which Elijah performed, which Jesus performed, which they say of all the holy ones of India, for instance, and in China too, and in Iran too, and also in the mythologies of the world, in the Greek myths, Thetis, the mother of Achilles, confers invulnerability upon him by dipping him in the river Styx, you see. Zarathustra confers invulnerability upon the prince Asfandiyar. All these things have this kind of meaning. Now you see, it must obviously be symbolical, mustn't it? Because in actual fact, Achilles was killed in the Trojan War, Asfandiyar died. This immortality, this invulnerability, doesn't mean that you'll never die. Siegfried had the Tarnhelm and he had this, that and the other, but he was slain. You see, one has to have the deep intelligence to know how to interpret these things and understand their inner meaning. Right, let's go on. How does one always asks, how do I become silent then? How do I become utterly free of all isolative self-consciousness? It's very simple really, but it's very difficult to do. It's a little bit like this. You can look at the score of the Hammerklavier Sonata, and you can follow it with your brain and imagine the sounds and play it and enjoy it that way by reading the score. But to play that, particularly that last movement, that terrific fugue of the Hammerklavier, is a very different task. It's a little bit like that. So I'll tell you how one becomes silent. By paying total attention to all the noise of the world. All the sound that the universe makes in the becoming process, in samsara as we call, that's the Sanskrit term for the becoming process, birth, death, beginning, ending, and so on. By paying full attention to it, Because as and when you can be totally attentive, that attention dissolves all the barriers between the finitude of the finite object or experience and person and the infinite reality, which is this infinite, immeasurable substance. The ground is the German word Urgrund, yes, which is the eternal ground and which has no thing in it, but only the primordial absolute energy. And it contains all the things which are the little obstructions which make the noise and the sound and so forth. Pay complete attention to this, and in your inner consciousness, the distinction disappears altogether. And then you are in the silent state. You are in the state of the Urgrund. Get it? So, to put it in the terms of the Upanishadic language, the Atma, and you remember I said the Atma is the eater-up of the mind, and in the mind are all the obstacles. The Atma gets disentangled from the net of discriminative consciousness, vijnana. It is because we are confined to discriminative consciousness, we function only in terms of sense perception and the ordinary brain and intellectual, logical intellectual interpretation. We are confined. See, as long as we have discriminative consciousness, we are alive in terms of the becoming process of samsara. We are caught in the realm of mortality. The Lord of Death is ultimately master over us. You see? But when you pay total attention and you have become free of all your conditioning inwardly, then Atma, the totality, the absolute consciousness, which the Upanishads talk of without hesitation, they use this term, absolute consciousness, both with respect to Brahman and Atma. That absolute consciousness functions freely through you because the net of discriminative consciousness has been removed. It's no longer caught in that net. That's why I said earlier on, transcendence sees transcendence. Eternal God sees and hears eternal God through you. You see what holiness means. You see what man's destiny is. This is the meaning of the word man. Man in the image of God. And then God, All Father Mind, created man in his own image, with whom he fell in love. For he was so like his father, his sire, so beautiful. This sort of, if we can, even at a distance, on the far horizon, catch a glimpse of this beauty, this wonder, you will know an inner happiness, an inner spiritual bliss, which is of the nature of the bliss of God. Ananda, as we say in India. This bliss which is utter peace. And this bliss you carry with you wherever you go. And in the midst of turmoil and storm and stress, your presence calms the stormy waters. When the disciples got frightened and awoke Jesus and said that the storm was raging and they might sink, and Jesus said, "Peace, be still," and the waters were still. This again is a symbolical way of talking of his influence upon his disciples. You can't go out into a stormy sea and say, "Peace, be still," and the storm will subside. And the perfected Holy One will never do that. You know why? The Holy One is always in perfect tune with the actual process. Then you might turn around and say to me, "But you just now said that his presence transmutes and perfects and all the rest of it. What does that mean?" His influence is such that the inner nature of an event, a situation, a person, an object undergoes a flowering out into perfection. That is the transmutation. Not stopping two armies from firing at each other with heavy guns and committing murder. It's not that. It doesn't interfere. All the terrible forces in the world which conspire to produce this catastrophe cannot be forcibly repressed. They have to be transmuted, transformed. And transformation takes time. What is important is that the Holy One changes, utterly changes the nature of your consciousness and your mind and your character. If that is changed, man ceases to do evil. And that's that, isn't it? One last word. Goodness. When the Atma looks through you, you are the grail of transcendence. No evil gets done by you or through you. And then, creative action in eternity, which goes on continuously throughout the universe, this creative action of transcendence itself goes on unhindered through you. And it is because of that that this indescribable influence spreads out from the Holy One. And you who are in this condition are in the state of supreme communion, not only when you enter the deeps of meditation and realize samadhi, but as you walk about, as you talk, as you work, as you meet your friends, as you eat and drink, and so on. You see how the totality of existence is transformed. And this state of perfect communion is the supreme active communion in which the perfected Holy Ones constantly live.